It's a joy for me to introduce my friend Chaz Edens as our preacher today. Chaz began his journey at the Mennonite Church right here at RMC when he was a student at NC State, earning his bachelor's in horticulture. He went on to study at Duke Divinity, and during that time, we went to church together at Chapel Hill Mennonite. Chaz then went on to serve as the director and garden manager of Anatoth Community Gardens in Cedar Grove, North Carolina. If that sounds familiar, it's because y'all have heard a sermon or two about Anatoth over the years. Now Chaz is a farmer at Eden's Meats, and we're grateful to have him with us today. Welcome, Chaz.
Good morning. It's great to be back here. We actually went to the old location first. We just followed our memory. My wife Hannah and I enjoyed worshiping with y'all many years ago. If you would please pray with me. God, may the words of my mouth and the meditation of all of our hearts be acceptable and pleasing to you. Amen. So like Melissa said, I used to run a community farm project in Cedar Grove, North Carolina, where I still live. We ran a summer internship there for young adults. The first week of the internship, I assigned a film called The Field. Has anyone here seen The Field? The Field has as its protagonist an Irishman named Bull McCabe, who's played by the actor John Hurt. It starts with a bit of foreshadowing. He and his son are throwing a donkey over a steep cliff into the ocean. We later learn that the donkey has trespassed into Bull's field. It is a field that Bull has tended to his entire life. He's removed all the stones in the field to make a fence around it. Bull doesn't technically own the field in a transactional sense. It actually belongs to a widow in the village. And yet the entire village is sure that the widow who owns the field will sell it to Bull for a fair price when she decides to sell it. But the widow has other plans. Instead of letting Bull more or less inherit the field, she tells him instead that he can bid on it at an open auction. Bull is at first distraught by this idea, but his concerns are assuaged by the fellow villagers at a local pub. Everyone knows it's your field, Bull. No one's going to outbid you. Bull feverishly collects every penny that he can before the auction. The auction day comes, and there are only two bidders, Bull, who believes the field is rightly his, and the American, a descendant from those who immigrated out of Ireland during the famine, who has returned with plans to turn the field into a parking lot for a new development, to bring industry and wealth back to his ancestors' small village. The crowd of villagers murmur, "No one has seen the American before. What is he doing at the auction?" The bidding starts, and Bull is quickly outbid by the American, who the auctioneer declares now rightly owns the field. What proceeds in the film is the breakdown of Bull McCabe. Without the field, where will his livelihood come from? His son will have nothing to inherit. In a dramatic scene, Bull looks at himself in the mirror, quizzically, unable to recognize himself. Without the field, he no longer has an identity. The mirror shatters. Why would I start a summer internship with this story? Why would I start a sermon with this story? The reason is because I would contend that most of us in this sanctuary actually have an easier time relating to the American in this story than Bull McCabe. Most of us have probably not lived in one place our entire lives. We haven't committed ourselves to such hard physical work. Our identities, our sense of right and wrong, are not as strongly tied to a place. We might sympathize with Bull's loss, but isn't his reaction a bit extreme? I mean, there are other fields, Bull. See, the American in this story and Bull have a different relationship with the field. They have different names for it. The American, perhaps like many of us, see it as an asset, as an investment. Bull sees it as a livelihood, as an extension of himself. Our relationships affect the names we assign to creation. And conversely, naming is a vocation that mediates our relationship with creation. The two go hand in hand. The vocation of naming and the embodied practices of caring for creation are inextricable. There are different ways of describing Bull's ontology, the position from which he sees the world and understands right and wrong. Call it his moral framework. Indigenous, agrarian, subsistence. Bull's orientation to the world, his relationship with the field, is closer to the billions of people around the world in what we Westerners might call poor or developing countries. Like those that I have visited, the tribes in the Rift Valley of Kenya, moving goats across the valley floor, or the families in Haiti who harvest the breadfruit from the shade tree and mash it into their night's dinner. There is a hardship to such a life that I don't want to overly romanticize. Some aspects of their impoverishment are evil and oppressive. And there is a precarity to a life that is so intimately tied to land where the variables of weather, pests, disease, predation can be the difference between nourishment and starvation. It is a marginal existence. But like Bull, those whose lives are connected to creation in this way, I think, are closer to understanding this vocation of naming and caring. In Genesis 1, God names creation. God called the light day and the darkness night. God called the dome sky. God called the dry land earth and the waters that were gathered together seas. In Genesis 2, God tells humans to name creation. So out of the ground, God formed every animal of the field and every bird of the air and brought them to humans to see what he would call them. And whatever humans called every living creature, that was its name. The humans gave names to all cattle and to the birds of the air and to every animal of the field. But for the humans, and that's where I'll end it. See, God gives humans the vocation of naming within the context of a garden where God has also given them dominion over the land, the vocation of tilling and keeping, or as Hebrew scholar Ellen Davis interprets, preserving and keeping. When our naming is detached from a place, from embodied work, it loses integrity and meaning. I was recently exchanging stories with a good friend of mine named Dane, who just finished his first year of teaching at UNC. And he was saying that he has found that students will often defend the positions on this or that issue more fiercely, less graciously when those positions aren't born out of authentic life experiences or relationships. They are forming names, forming opinions, forming categories, largely based on the names and opinions of others. It is a language constructed on a hollow foundation. As I also experienced working with the young adult interns I worked with, this comes with a particular existential anxiety that looms over an education system so intensely focused on the purely intellectual endeavor of learning the names of things, and yet seems to be so disinterested in the work of bodies. As one of my interns put it, in a botany class, I am learning all of the characteristics of plants, all of the things that can kill them, the conditions that they need to grow, but I've never actually even tried to grow a plant before. In many ways, all of our lives and our work now are mediated by technologies like the internet, social media, the 24/7 news cycle that makes it easier to create names, categories, opinions of people that are detached from actual relationships. Behind screens, language is abstracted and too often becomes vitriolic and divisive. The writer and activist Wendell Berry writes in his essay, Standing by Words, that language should follow these three guidelines. Number one, it should work to designate its object precisely. Two, its speaker must stand by it, must believe it, be accountable for it, must be willing to act on it. And number three, the community must know what it is that they are talking about. See, it is dangerous when someone learns a name without a relationship with what they are naming. Naming, then, instead of becoming a vocation of care, can be wielded as a weapon of violence. Because it is easier to do violence to a person or a place that has been compartmentalized with our language. Racial slurs or declarations of war against certain countries are ways of naming that have been weaponized. We see the vocation of naming in the ministry of Jesus. When Jesus visits the woman at the well, when Jesus calls Zacchaeus down from the tree, Jesus is using naming as a way of transgressing the names and labels that have been given to people to subjugate them, ostracize them. He replaces those divisive names with names that make a relationship possible, a relationship of care and kindness. Jesus entered into this world, I think it's no mistake, as the son of a carpenter, in a barn. His arrival was greeted upon by shepherds. He entered into a world more similar to Bull McCabe, to the tribes in Kenya, to the Haitian family. As the liberation theologians remind us, Jesus came to live with and to liberate the poor. We should assume that such liberation, we shouldn't assume that such liberation means occasional charity or even the striving towards an affluence and loneliness that many of us in the United States have acquired. For those in the global South, say, to develop their economies to the same levels of production, waste, loneliness, and estrangement that those of us in the West have achieved. Rather, Jesus lived amongst those whose material existence was tied to the land because, I believe, they were most receptive to the gospel. when he tells his disciples to throw their nets on the other side of the boat. This is not just a parlor trick that catches their attention, but would have affected their material existence in a serious way. Those with a proximity to death are more receptive to life. If we humble ourselves, we can learn about the relationship between the vocation of work and naming by following Jesus into such solidarity. Through solidarity with those whose existence is tied to the land and working towards a liberation from the evil and oppressive aspects of such poverty, we too can find our liberation from the tyrannies of capitalism, industrialism, militarism. As Gustavo Gutierrez, the liberation theologian, says, the goal is not only better living conditions, but a radical change of structures, a social revolution. It is a continuous creation, never ending, of a new way to be human, a permanent cultural revolution. To co-create with God, we need to take naming seriously. To take the vocation of naming seriously, we need to be in relationship with what we are naming. To narrow the proximity between ourselves and what we are naming, we need to put down the screens, put down the newspaper, unplug from social media, and get to know the creation around us. What I have appreciated about the daily work of tending to plants and animals, of farming, is that it teaches me, sometimes in brutal ways, that this work, this vocation, is continual, habitual work. It is not elective. But it is through this work, and the 12 years or so I have been engaged in this work in the same rural community, that my names for creation around me have changed. The bacon that I eat is not just a package with a label and a price tag at the grocery store. It came from a pig that I cared for almost a year, a pig who made a sacrifice. And Fred is not just my gun-toting, Trump-supporting neighbor. He's also the neighbor who helped me remove the starter from my truck once. This doesn't mean that everyone needs to quit their jobs and become a farmer. In fact, we would do better to resist the mindset of specialization, I think, compartmentalization. And it's not something that we can achieve only as individuals. As a church, how can we engage in embodied practices that, like Jesus, transgress the names that are given to God's creation all around us? How can we humble ourselves and learn from those who more closely resemble those whom Jesus came to live amongst and liberate? Eating together is, I think, an increasingly radical embodied practice and something that resonated with me in my first experiences here with Raleigh Mennonite. And I think it's a good place to continue these conversations.